This is Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Khannab.
And I'm Jamal Dajani.
Jamal, the catastrophe in Gaza and the genocide continues unabated. 32,000 Palestinians have been murdered by the Israeli military. 75,000 have been injured. Thousands remain unaccounted for and most likely dead underneath the rubble. And UN Secretary General Antony Guterres was at the Rafah border yesterday screaming to the world that the famine is going full steam ahead because of the Israeli military blocking aid getting into Gaza. And we know, Jamal, that children in Gaza are literally starving to death. And yet Benjamin Netanyahu continues to telegraph to the world that he's going to invade and commit a massacre on top of the genocide. So we're going to be covering all those things today, including a recent eyewitness that said that the Israeli military raped Palestinian women before they killed them at Al-Shifa Hospital, which has been reinvaded and reattacked again in the last few days. In addition, we're going to look at and talk about leaked Israeli drone footage that was aired by Al Jazeera this week, which shows recent Israeli strikes on unarmed Palestinian men in the Khan Yunis area. And the last story that we're going to cover today is that, you know, Jamal, we're always looking for, you know, pundits to speak about in very deep ways what's happening in Palestine. And of course, no one is more ridiculous and outrageous and more ignorant and more depraved than Jared Kushner. And even Jared Kushner has outdone himself yet again. He described in the last week, in the midst of a genocide, in the midst of starvation of Palestinian children, he had the audacity to say that the property, the seafront property in Gaza, was, quote, valuable, and said that Israel should move Palestinian civilians into the Negev, desert. So Jared Kushner is already talking about plans for redeveloping Gaza while Palestinians are being murdered and starving to death. But before we get to that, Jamal, we're going to watch a really amazing interview that you did with distinguished professor of history, Walter Hickson. He wrote a book talking about the influences of AIPAC. It's a really excellent book. The book is entitled Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Mideast Policy. It's a comprehensive history of the crucial role of the Israeli lobby. Amazing book, a great interview.
That's right, Jess. And AIPAC is now under attack. More than 100 Jewish well-known people have signed a letter denouncing it. And especially now, since we're approaching the elections, their role is getting more important than ever. They're going to pour in $100 million to unseat candidates.
Democrats
who basically are against Israeli policies. Let's watch Professor Hickson. This November, the American voters will elect a new president. Most likely, it will be a rematch between Biden and Trump. They will also be voting for their representatives in Congress. In 2025, we might be witnessing a major change in the landscape of American politics. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has started its campaign with a $100 million budget to unseat members of Congress who are critical of Israel, especially during its onslaught on Gaza, which has left more than 32,000 Palestinians dead. Why does such a lobby wield such power on American politics? A lobby which advocates and now helps to both elect and unseat U.S. politicians on behalf of a foreign country. Joining us on Arab Talk this week to deconstruct AIPAC's influence on U.S. politics is Walter Hickson. His book entitled Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy is a comprehensive history of the crucial role of the Israel lobby. Hickson was a distinguished professor of history at the University of Akron and is an author who has written numerous books about the history of U.S. foreign relations, several of which have recently focused on the issue of Israel and Palestine. Welcome to Arab Talk, Walter.
Great to be with you.
So I remember learning more about AIPAC back in the 1980s by reading the book They Dare to Speak Out, written by former Congressman Paul Findlay. It was one of the first books to speak about the pervasive influence of AIPAC on American policy and institutions. Now, fast forward to your book, Architects of Repression. What has changed in these almost 40 years, and how has AIPAC metastasized to have such increased influence and stronghold on American politics?
Well, to fully understand AIPAC and many, many other associated organizations that comprise the Israel lobby, it's not solely AIPAC, but certainly AIPAC is the spearhead. But there are literally hundreds of organizations that collaborate and work with Israel, in fact, to promote Israeli national interests. What's changed is even more money and more power. But to really understand the lobby, you have to go back as well as forward to its creation and evolution. But Paul Findlay well understood what was happening and paid the price for it. He was one of the early representatives to be targeted and defeated by the Israel lobby.
So on the one hand, AIPAC and its affiliates that you've mentioned are realizing big success. They publicly boast about the percentage of success in having its sponsored candidates elected. I see this almost on a daily basis on Twitter and other social media sites. At the same time, its influence is completely exposed and receiving pushback. For example, just this week, more than 100 prominent Jewish Americans signed a statement condemning AIPAC's increasingly aggressive interventions in the U.S. elections, particularly the Democratic Party primaries, where it's spending tens of millions of dollars to unseat progressives. Do you think that this will backfire?
Well, there's a number of important points in there. The public opinion of American Jews is very important, and the majority are not pro-AIPAC, but a small minority of extremely wealthy, mostly Orthodox Jews who fund the Israel lobby predominantly have more power because of the way we enable in this country money to dominate politics. So AIPAC is loaded with wealth and very determined, relentless, and very effective lobby. They know what they're doing. They've been at it for decades, and they're very good at it. Yes, I think things are changing slowly, but the fact that Jewish public opinion predominantly, most Jews are liberal and not of AIPAC's worldview, I think that's important, but it doesn't obviate the impact of the money in politics, particularly on the U.S. Congress.
It's astounding how many Congress members and senators receive hefty campaign contributions through AIPAC. You gave an example of how Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate minority leader, sought out AIPAC early in his career. Also, it's public knowledge that President Biden is also one of the top recipients of AIPAC's money. Using these examples, how does AIPAC manage to take control of U.S. politicians early on in their careers?
Well, this really goes back to World War II, and just a brief overview. The issue at the time, of course, coming off of the horrific Nazi genocide, there was a drive to resettle Jews, particularly in the United States, which had the largest Jewish population in the world, and really New York was the capital of world Jewry. And so the lobby began in an effort to get congressional funding to resettle Jews. And it was so effective that the lobby just grew and grew and has mushroomed. And really, I don't think it's too strong to say it absolutely dominates the U.S. Congress. And the examples you cite, McConnell and Biden, are certainly excellent examples. They've gotten as much or more money as anyone. But maybe a better example of how powerful and effective the lobby is would be to cite Hakeem Jeffries, for example, or Cory Booker. These are two very progressive African-American high-level politicians in the United States who are passionate and eloquent advocates for justice, for racial justice, except, of course, for Palestine. And there they are totally loyal to AIPAC and the Israel lobby. And they enjoy, especially Booker, has many times appeared at the AIPAC national meeting and spoken passionately in behalf of Israel and in utter indifference to the suffering and as we speak today, slaughter of Palestinians.
So you've mentioned that the early days of AIPAC and of course that coincided the which was basically 1948. This was an anomaly that as it was in this year in the wake of the atrocities of World War II. And but at the same time, the global community had come to reject racialized violence and embrace universal human rights with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. So what was the narrative that the Israel lobby needed to create to justify support for its settler colonial project in that political climate?
Right. Well, you've put your finger on, you know, one of the main arguments in my book that helps understand the lobby's role and its importance, because in fact, it did come into being at precisely the same time, as you mentioned, that the UN International Declaration of Human Rights and condemnation of such practices as ethnic cleansing and genocide were condemned in the world community. And yet, this is what Israel, as a settler colonial state, and Israel's basic identity, much like American identity in the 19th and 18th centuries, or Australian, or many other examples in world history, was a settler colonial state that was committed to driving out the indigenous population and replacing them. And that's what settler states do. But for Israel, the challenge was that this was the 20th century, and the second half of the 20th century, not the 19th, not the era of manifest destiny, when there was much more bald, violent national state actions and ethnic cleansing like manifest destiny. So propaganda and public information were all the more important because Israel had to cover up, essentially, its ethnic cleansing actions and its establishment. Israel, I describe as a congenitally aggressive settler state. And that identity was in contradiction to the international community's transition to a human rights discourse. So this made public information and propaganda all the more important. And the way that operated was by condemning understandable resistance by Palestinians as terror. And the trope of terror and the discourse such as, you know, they only want to drive Israel into the sea, this kind of discourse became a hallmark of the lobby and then the fundraising and the money to support politicians who would back this Israeli policies and to condemn and try to defeat those who didn't. So that became the signature of the lobby, using money to manipulate the U.S. Congress, because not all presidents, for example, Eisenhower, the first George Bush, Jimmy Carter, were willing to simply cave into the lobby. I mean, almost all presidents did eventually cave into the lobby and do cave into the lobby, even Obama, for example. But they didn't necessarily want to, all of them. They just were really compelled to by the power of the lobby. So the State Department and the presidents were, in a sense, trumped, so to speak, by the Israel lobby focus on the Congress and its ability to dominate the U.S. Congress.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has equated the Israel lobby's dominance with that of the NRA. However, this is a lobby which prioritizes the interests of a foreign country, unlike the NRA, which is basically a foreign country, Israel. How did AIPAC manage to evade registering as a foreign agent?
Yeah, this is a fascinating and complicated history. I recommend to people the site IRMEP. It's a Washington think tank that focuses on the history of the lobby through digging up documents through the Freedom of Information Act. If you really want to dig into this, go to Grant Smith's site, IRMEP. But one of the ways they could avoid this is because many, of course, members of AIPAC are Americans. They're not Israelis. And so many have dual citizenship. And many, they certainly serve the interests of Israel. And I would say not only, you know, dual loyalty, but Israel is their first loyalty. Some of the main donors, like Haim Saban, who's a donor to Democratic Party politicians, is famous for saying, "I'm a one-issue man, and my issue is Israel." He's an American, so, you know, he's not a foreign agent, but at the same time, he serves the interests of a foreign country. But yes, that was a threat to the lobby that it had to circumvent and avoid, and there's a very interesting, complex history behind all that, and through the evolution of AIPAC, which had other names previously until about 1960 when it settled in as AIPAC. But it's always been a product of American Zionists working closely with Israel and working closely with organizations such as the Congress of Presidents of American Jewish Organizations, which has long come together to devise policy and implement policy. And again, controlling the Congress is the number one priority that they've been so successful at.
President Biden has been in denial about how much harm to his reelection in 2024, his unrestrained support for Israel to commit genocide in Gaza has caused. Does he think that the AIPAC armor is invincible?
That's a good question. I think he probably hopes, in terms of Biden's political ambitions, that somehow this will settle down and people will forget about it by the time of the election and vote for him because Trump is the only alternative. But this is not going to be easy to set aside. This is a wholesale slaughter that's going on day after day. And really, as you well know, underscores the tremendous power of the lobby because, you know, just imagine if these were 32,000 Jews and 100 Jewish children a day being slaughtered. You know, it wouldn't last a day before it was stopped. But this really attests to the power of the lobby to have its way so that the president of the United States cannot even, and neither did Chuck Schumer in his speech, and neither did the UN resolution, simply come out and demand a ceasefire now, stop the slaughter, stop the murder, and find a settlement with hostages, et cetera. The fact that Biden, the president of the United States, can't do that really underscores the power of the lobby.
So, I mean, this is a moral issue, as you've mentioned. I mean, if it was any other country, let's say a European country, there'll be a major outcry. The issue of the ethnic cleansing and ongoing atrocities Israel perpetrates against Palestinians. But from a purely self-interested perspective, why is Israel exceptionalism in our foreign policy detrimental to the United States? How is it harming our culture and society?
I think in a number of ways. You could start with simply the absurdity of the money, the allocations. Israel has received more foreign assistance than any other country in the world since World War II from the United States. Now, here's a country of 9 million people, which is highly developed and already the military powerhouse of the Middle East. It doesn't need American financial assistance. It certainly needs spare parts and bombs and technical support, which we're providing in the midst of this slaughter. But, you know, it's... It's something that the lobby has effectively done that, as you say, has eroded American moral standing in the world. Oftentimes I'll hear from people, well, Israel's an important ally to the United States. But when you ask yourself, what has that alliance produced that's favorable to the United States and to the American national interest, I'm not sure what you come up with. A series of forever wars that have been ineffective and have helped spur tremendous blowback against the United States, including 9/11. Part of the motive for 9/11 was certainly the decades of U.S.-supported repression in Palestine. So that's the amazing thing about it, is it does not benefit the American national interest. It does erode any pretense of the United States standing as a moral leader of the world. It's a morally bankrupt foreign policy that prevails in large part because of the incredible power of the lobby and its hold on the Congress.
APEC is the hub of influence, but there are many affiliates, such as the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and then you said hundreds of others, and of course, corporate media, that take up the narratives that always justify Israel's actions. What is the complete menu of tactics deployed to keep support for Israel intact?
Well, the signature tactic, as you've already suggested, is providing or withholding funding to members of Congress. You support us, we'll fund you. That's essentially what they told Mitch McConnell when he barely won his first race in Kentucky. He went to APEC and said, what do I have to do to get your support? And they said, just, you know, support, follow our policies toward Israel, and we'll fund you. And they have ever since. So certainly the money is a big part of it. The discourse that I mentioned, this, you know, trope of these relentless, fanatical, terroristic Arabs wanting to drive Israel into the sea as opposed to people trying to defend their homelands or today just simply stay alive. The relentless opposition to the so-called peace process, which I call the mythical peace process, because it's simply a discourse of there being a peace process for decades. Meanwhile, more than 700,000 illegal settlements were erected in the occupied territories. Language propaganda is very important. What's equally disturbing is today any criticism of Israel is equated with anti-Semitism by the lobby. The lobby is attacking freedom of speech in the United States. In the United States, it's very difficult to criticize Israel. Academics are subjected to a chilling effect. Palestinian students who form organizations and want to be members of Students for Justice in Palestine on college campuses are attacked. You know, students are attacked. And it doesn't take much but for wealthy donors to call a college president or a member of the board of trustees and say, hey, your campus is tolerating anti-Semitic criticism of Israel, and they'll cave into it. The willingness of college presidents, for example, to cave into the lobby is, it's sad to see that they won't stand for academic freedom and freedom of speech. So it's gone so far as really to undermine freedom of speech and to sanction smear tactics. So there's a whole panoply of tactics. APAC, if you were to Google APAC headquarters, you'll see a big building on H Street in Washington. It's a multi-story office building with more than 200 employees. It has millions of dollars. It amuses me in a sad way when people deny the influence of the lobby, because it's very real and tangible. And anyone who thinks that all that money and all that effort by these very dedicated employees doesn't do anything is sadly mistaken. It's a highly effective lobby and is, in fact, as AOC said, equivalent to the big pharma or the gun lobby in its effectiveness. So it's not just a powerful lobby of a foreign government, it's a powerful lobby, period.
On the issue of freedom of speech, APAC, along with the ADL, have been pushing for laws on the state and local levels, as you've mentioned, to censor criticism of Israel. So why is it one of the main drivers of the proposed bill to ban TikTok? I mean, this is the recent thing that has been in the news. and cede congressional powers to the president to ban any social media he deems a threat going forward.
Well, it's just an example of where we're heading with this. And it's, you know, it's one thing if you're an American and maybe, you know, the Middle East isn't a major issue for you, or you're not fully aware of what's going on or that concerned about it. This erosion of free speech is attacking American rights. It's one thing to people will maybe tolerate, sadly, what's happening on the ground in Palestine, or it's distant from them. But this transition in recent years to really undermining American democracy, which is happening in tandem with you know, many other aspects that threaten this democracy in the United States, ought to be disturbing to every American.
Despite AIPAC's enormous influence, has it peaked? Is it on a decline? There seems to be a panic recently, and more people are speaking out against it. There's also a leaked audio of a panicking Jonathan Greenblatt, the executive director of the Anti-Defamation League, sounding the alarm about Gen Z or Generation Z's stand against Israel on TikTok. Do you think that American youth are breaking free from AIPAC's yoke?
Well, in some respects, it's encouraging to see this and to see the condemnation and really to see the political threat Biden faces as a result of this, which, you know, may force the Democratic Party toward a more rational and less cruel and murderous foreign policy. You know, this moniker of Genocide Joe can't be something that Biden relishes, you know, the label. So, you know, I don't know what, obviously, historians don't know what's going to happen in the future. We never know. You can't predict these things. But certainly it's becoming more of a factor that they have to deal with. You would like to think younger people would put some pressure on. On the other hand, the political system is so fueled by money, and it's, you know, the Democratic Party has just a tiny progressive wing that is bold enough to make an issue of this, despite the, you know, not just funding candidates against them, but a steady series of death threats to people like Ilhan Omar. The fact that, you know, Betty McCollum can propose that that U.S. funding be linked to Israel jailing children, and she's attacked as a supporter of terrorism. So there's a lot of money and determination. AIPAC has often panicked over things or seemed to be panicky, but they're very relentless. They're very well funded. They're very effective and knowledgeable about how to lobby. They are careful to respond to what's happening in public. For example, they're not holding their big, showy Washington annual meeting as they used to hold. They would bring in American politicians to cravenly acknowledge support for everything Israel wanted to do. I think they've decided that is too public, and they're acting more behind the scenes and through this distribution of wealth and threats and repression of free speech. So I don't know how it's going to play out. Certainly there's some forces that AIPAC and the Democratic Party ought to be very concerned about, because this, as many people have noted, could very well be the source of Biden's defeat in states like Michigan that are so crucial.
Well, do you think like Biden's defeat, because at least for now, he seems to be in denial or a little bit trying to have some rapprochement with the Arab American community. But also, they're targeting that, like I've mentioned, we've mentioned earlier, they're targeting progressive Democrats with a $100 million budget to unseat them. If this happens, would that shift the loyalty to AIPAC by at least the Democratic Party?
Well, it's a very powerful lobby and a very well-funded lobby, but they don't win them all. And they can't. You know, they failed to defeat Omar and failed to defeat OAC, and they've even lost some of their races to a longtime stalwart pro-Zionist politicians in the United States. So even with all their wealth and power, a small congressional district, lots of times people will stand by their representatives. But again, they're a tiny minority, and they can't command policy. I don't think AIPAC's necessarily going to drive them all out, but they already are pretty dominant in Congress, and I don't see them losing that anytime soon until we had, you know, somehow, if it ever occurred, that a progressive president would come to power and the Congress would enact serious campaign finance laws. But as it is with money commanding, this puts AIPAC in good position, but they don't win them all.
The book is Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy. Go to walterhickson.com to get a copy. Walter, thank you for coming on Arab Talk.
Great to be with you. Best wishes.
That's the voice of distinguished professor of history, Walter Hickson, discussing his recently published book, Architects of Repression, How the Israeli Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy. It's a compelling argument, Jamal. You know, you and I and many other people have been talking about the regressive kind of depraved influence of AIPAC on the United States and foreign policy. But Professor Hickson has detailed it and described it historically in ways that are very compelling. It looks like it's a book that maybe the Congress and the Senate should read too.
Well, Jess, I've mentioned to Professor Hickson that the first time that I've kind of read about AIPAC in details was in the 80s with Paul, former Congressman for Paul Findlay, who wrote the book,
right,
They Dare to Speak. Basically, he documented how they went after him for basically saying no, you know, to Israel.
Right.
And basically got him to, you know, to lose the election. And then fast forward now, almost 40 years. Well,
right.
Professor, you know, this new book basically updates what's been happening with AIPAC and how,
right,
it has basically gotten more powerful and more influential. That it's now, it's really actively, as we've mentioned in the intro, they're going to put $100 million. Imagine, this is a foreign,
well,
this is a lobby that basically advocates for a foreign country to unseat,
well,
elected officials in the United States.
Yeah, and look at, we scream every day about Russia influence on the U.S. elections, about China's influence on the U.S. elections. We scream, we shout. It's done under the radar. But here we have an organization, Jamal, AIPAC, which does it publicly, which does it openly, which does it proudly, talking about what I believe, and I think what you and Professor Hickson probably would believe, an undermining of U.S. democracy by the way it promotes certain candidates over other candidates. We have to remember that AIPAC has put basically bullseyes around Democrat candidates in the Congress and the Senate. They want to get rid of any candidate that doesn't have complete fidelity, not to the United States, Jamal. We're not talking about United States. They don't care that these congresspeople feel about the United States. They want unequivocal 100% fidelity to the apartheid state of Israel. And if you commit to that, then you're going to get millions of dollars in support for your reelection. That, to me, is a much better, much bigger threat to democracy than Russia or China, Jamal. But who's talking about it?
No one, until recently. And with this, yeah, book, and hopefully more, you know, and there is a panic. We've talked about this last week, and we've talked,
right,
about it today in the show during the interview. There is a panic by AIPAC. There's a panic by the ADL. They're now panicking from Gen Z, you know, and TikTok. And of course, that's why now TikTok is under scrutiny, and
it's going to get banned, probably going to get banned in the United States. Moving on to the next story, Jess, and going into Gaza, there is a disturbing story that has not been reported in U.S. media and hardly been, you know, very little, that the Israeli military now is have been report, you know, Israeli occupation forces have been reportedly engaged in rape crimes against Gazan women during their ongoing raid in Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest health facility basically there. And there's an eyewitness by civilian Jamila Al-Hissi, who was trapped in a building near the health facility. And this is in an interview with Al Jazeera. She reported that the Israeli occupation forces were kidnapping and killing women during the raid at the hospital. And I'm quoting here, she said, "They raped women, kidnapped women, executed women, and pulled dead bodies from under the rubble to unleash their dogs on them." She said that nothing is worse than this situation. Is there anything more horrifying than hearing women call for help? She was listening to them. When we try to reach them to provide assistance, they shoot at us. You know, so this is a very disturbing story at a time when the Israeli Hasbara machine in this country keeps repeating the story about raped women without providing any basically witnesses to that, except the stories are based on allegations by one individual. And of course, now no one now talks about the 40 beheaded babies. This disappeared, yet they keep repeating the story, and real rape is happening. And then, you know, last week, during my interview last week with the UN rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, there is also evidence about ongoing rape, especially when women are held in Israeli prisons or under detention.
Well, this is why this is an extraordinarily disturbing story, Jamal, because as you rightly point out, that infamous report put out by the New York Times about the sexual assaults that were alleged by this one Israeli woman whose own family, it's important to know this, whose own family discounted and denied what she said. And so that story has fallen by the wayside, even though they keep promoting it, you know, in various channels. Here we have an eyewitness account by a Palestinian woman in Gaza who heard the screams, who saw with her own eyes the sexual brutality and sexual assault that the Israeli military engaged with against Palestinian civilian women. And there is nothing in the media here. Nothing in the mainstream media, nothing even in the kind of non-mainstream media. This is a story that was put out by Al Jazeera, but it seems like there's, again, radio silence when it comes to the sexual assault of Palestinian women that is occurring right now. And as you said, and rightfully, the Palestinian women in Israeli prisons right now routinely are sexually assaulted, and this has been well documented over the decades. So we see the Hasbara machine kind of influencing the mainstream media in terms of the asymmetry, in terms of the sexual assault reporting that goes on against Palestinian women. Jamal, can you say a little bit more about the Al Jazeera reporting on this? Are they going to continue to report on this story? It seems like a very important story.
Well, it is. No, they've been reporting on this story, and I'm surprised that an investigation, at least, like the United States has not called for an investigation about this, unlike the next story, which we'll be talking about it. And of course, hopefully the UN officials will investigate this and more eyewitnesses will come and testify. But the main issue is that these women are being raped and then they're being executed. So you have, right, you know, that's what's going on. And this is just a woman who was hiding in a building across from there, hearing them pleading for their lives and yelling and so forth. But in the next story, Jess, which is now, the U.S. Saturday said that the leaked video, there's a leaked video showing an Israeli drone. I'm sure you saw this video and other people's posted all over the internet, targeting four unarmed Palestinian civilians in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. And they called on, of course, they called on Israel to investigate. Imagine, this is always asking the rapist to investigate, right? Asking the murderer to investigate. So they called on Israel to investigate, and between quotes here, credible allegations of law of war violations. And when asked about the video, a State Department spokesperson said that the contents of the video are disturbing. We have not verified the footage, but we have asked the Israelis for more information and investigation. What do you expect Israel is going to say, Jess?
Well, the same thing they've been saying forever, Jamal, that they didn't do the murder, they didn't do the attacks, they didn't do the bombings. They're going to deny it as they usually do. It's an insulting kind of statement by this spokesperson. It's insulting to hear the United States, when they actually have the drone footage, the actual footage of the murder, of the assault on these unarmed Palestinian civilians. All they can say is, well, we'll let the Israelis investigate it. Yet the international community is the one, international law experts are the ones that should be investigating these war crimes, just like South Africa put its brief through the ICJ. The same kind of analysis should be performed by the international community to look at these war crimes. I mean, this is not part of what we were going to talk about today, but this is part of the ongoing investigation that the apartheid state is committing war crimes in Gaza, unfettered, just kind of with impunity, ongoingly. And no one is doing anything about it, Jamal.
And just the video is so clear to the naked eye.
It is.
So imagine this should be investigated by military, U.S. military experts. And they know what they're doing. They can tell you what's going on. The scenes aired by Al Jazeera, and again, people can watch it online, captured from an Israeli drone in Khan Yunis, basically. And showing the pursuit of the four Palestinian youth, and they're targeting them with several missiles. Two of them were killed with the first missile. Then the third and fourth were killed with two more missiles. It's very clear from the footage that the four civilians did not carry weapons and did not pose any threat. After the two youths were killed in the first hit, the third boy was seen moving away from the targeted site, but the drone followed him and bombed him. I mean, targeted assassination. They just like were, you know, going after these people. They didn't carry any weapons. And now, you know, the United States, after watching this, because it's really embarrassing. It's some, you know, the difference now. I mean, you could say sometimes, like, there are stories, just like when we talk about allegations, that's an eyewitness. But this is a footage that you can watch what's going on in real time. And then the United States answer is like unverified. They use the word unverified. And they use the other sentence, oh, we asked the Israelis to investigate. It's just ludicrous. Can you imagine if this happened in the Ukraine, or this happened to Israelis, you'll have like all these different countries conducting their investigation and yelling about, you know, murder and assassination, but not when it comes to Palestinians.
Well, Jamal, I think, you know, this is an important thing that we'll probably get to in future shows, but we're seeing a small shift in the political stance of the United States. It's small. It's not having any direct impact on the lives of Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank, even though Israel continues to steal land in the West Bank. They just announced another tender for stealing 5 more acres of Palestinian land in the West Bank to build even more settlements. So we see these little shifts, like, oh, the United States put a ceasefire proposal on the table for the UN, even though it wasn't really a ceasefire proposal. That's just what they called it. But if you read it, it really wasn't. We're seeing these small shifts because, Jamal, when we look at the eyewitness accounts of sexual assault by Israeli soldiers, when we look at the drone footage of Israel continuing to commit war crimes, the United States is seeing the political writing on the wall. Not that they care about Palestinian lives being murdered, children starving to death. They really don't care about this. But they're beginning to do the political calculation about whether giving Israel the green light to commit murder and war crimes is going to help them get reelected. I mean, this is going to be part of our analysis going through the elections coming up in November. But I think topics like this and the ridiculous statements coming from spokespeople are really going to harm the prospect for a re-election for Biden and Harris. But
there is something we'll more see. Ridiculous, Jess. Your favorite son-in-law, President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is bubbling with fresh ideas on how to resolve.
He's got great ideas.
The Israel-Hamas war. I mean, this is the guy who came up with the great idea of having, you know, the peace deal of the century.
Abraham Accords.
The Abraham
Accords. Yes, the Abraham.
And we see then, we are seeing the fruits of the Abraham Accord that brought prosperity to the Palestinian people. So his new idea now, and this is, again, we have the video, which first, you know what? Let's watch the video, Jess.
In Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards. Number one, you want to get as many civilians out of Rafah as possible. I think that you want to try to clear that out. If I was Israel right now, I would just bulldoze something in the Negev. I would try to move people in there. I know that won't be the popular thing to do, but I think that that's a better option to do so you can go in and finish the job.
So this was Jared Kushner.
I mean, this is Jared Kushner, Jamal, the prince of peace in the Middle East, whose father was in jail, who spent time in jail for felonies for committing fraud and other financial fraud, spent time in jail, whose father-in-law was the president of the United States, Donald Trump, and whose home, Jared Kushner's home, is where Bibi Netanyahu used to stay in Jared Kushner's bedroom when Bibi would come and visit the United States. So here we have the fresh prince of foreign policy, Jared Kushner. While Palestinians are starving to death, Jamal, murdered in Gaza, genocide being committed, he wants to develop the seafront property and move Palestinians to the Negev Desert. It sounds like he's advocating for ethnic cleansing again. And, you know, he's getting a pass. Who? Did you hear anything from the Biden administration about this or anything else, Jamal?
Nah. And mind you, this, by the way, this, a panel he was on at Harvard University happened in February, except now the video has been posted on YouTube just recently. That's why. So this has been going on. It took a while.
Right.
So, but others might have known about it, obviously, what he had been saying. I mean, it was in Harvard. And what I saw in the video, Jess, again, how illiterate, aside from being offensive, that he is so illiterate about the Middle East, aside from being offensive and greedy, and just like wants to basically get on the action of developing real estate and the openness about the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Gaza. He's talking about taking people from their homes and lands and businesses, even though now most of these have been destroyed and families. And again, pushing them into the Negev desert, the wasteland, basically, that most of it Israel does not use, in the Negev desert, because now he's talking about that because they stopped talking about moving them into the Sinai desert after Egypt refused to do that. So now they're talking about the Negev desert. Why not? Move them from the Negev desert. Doesn't this remind you, sadly, of what happened to the natives in this country, what happened to the Aborigines in Australia? They got pushed into the deep into the heart of Australia, away from the coastland. What happened to the Hawaiians in Hawaii? You know, now you don't see them owning beachfront properties. You know, that's all that he's thinking about, building hotels and luxury apartment buildings and getting rid of the indigenous population in Gaza.
But Jamal, let's be clear. Harvard is giving Jared Kushner a free pass. Harvard University is allowing this basically intellectual war criminal, this intellectual, I can't say this on the air, obviously, but this intellectual idiot, Jared Kushner, who has done more damage to the Middle East with his Abraham Accords, a free pass to speak at a university like that about ethnic cleansing. Let's turn the tables, Jamal. What if a Palestinian American went to Harvard or some other Ivy League school and proposed that Israelis should be removed from land or anything like that? I think that would be a pretty big story. But Jared Kushner is given a free pass to advocate for ethnic cleansing and developing land while a genocide is going on. We just shake our heads, Jamal, and hearing that he got a free pass at Harvard and nobody has called him out on this. Really, I mean, this is something that the Biden administration, if they really wanted to get reelected and kind of make amends for their horrific foreign policy in Palestine, might say something about.
Yeah. And check this out when his interviewer, Harvard professor Tariq Masood, seemed shocked at the proposal and asked if he had heard this idea being floated within Israel. Kushner shrugged and said, "I don't know. I'm sitting in Miami Beach right now. I'm looking at this situation. I'm just thinking, what would I do if I were there?" You know, it's like sitting in Miami Beach, and that's what he said.
Unbelievable, man. Well, what I got to say to everybody just before we close, Jamal, Jared Kushner, if Trump gets reelected, and I believe Trump is going to get reelected, he will be another force in kind of detailing the new Middle East policy for Palestine. So people should be ready when Jared Kushner takes over in his shadow role of Middle East peace negotiator when Trump gets reelected.
You've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Go to our website, arabtalkradio.com, to download the latest episodes, and we'll talk to you next week.
We'll see you next week.